Hello, and welcome to the A's Pod, episode 3.2, presented by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. This is our post-Indiana episode, but really it's going to be more of a general program feelings and also basketball episode, so don't run. Don't run. joining me, as always, is Connor and Dan. Hosts of what is now called the Yet Another Michigan Football Podcast, I believe.
Yes. So, I, you know, naming it after my Twitter handle was always tacky, and I really appreciate none of you, like, you know, calling me out on that.
Yeah, who names a podcast after themselves? What kind of asshole?
But yeah, so Yet Another Michigan Football Podcast. Connor and I, you know, we go pretty in depth on position by position. I would say the dynamic is, you know, I'm the realist, Connor's the optimist, although now we're pretty much both realists. The season has forced us that way. But, you know, if you can't get enough talking about this Michigan football team, go check us out.
Oh, man.
And Connor, you thankfully have other endeavors that have nothing to do with Michigan football.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for Dan because we spent all spring and summer talking about Michigan football, and then we just, you know, got it in the face and the soul dong and everywhere else the last couple weeks. So, but luckily, I have other interests, like you said. I run a newsletter that's not about football at all or about sports. It's called A Lonely Impulse of Delight. It's on Substack. It's about how stories work. I talk about different narrative arts things in a way that I hope is fun and accessible. And every week, I also analyze Calvin and Hobbes, which I hope is fun. So yeah, check that out. That's at connorrosesouther.substack.com, or you can look it up as A Lonely Impulse of Delight Substack.
And it's now linked in the show notes because I am working on being a less terrible show host. with that, we're now going to sink into our post-Indiana feelings very quickly. We're over it. Those are the feelings. So what we're actually going to do is kind of spread the listener mailbag across all of our segments because they really cover a gamut this week. And the first one is that we're going to look at here is such a kind of overarching question that kind of I thought was a good lead in to what we're going to be discussing for a lot of this at a more granular level. So let's start with this question from @LotReed on Twitter. At a higher level, do you think the story of Harbaugh at Michigan can be boiled down to a simple narrative? And if so, what would it be? Or do you think it's only best understood as a more complex, multifaceted narrative? Dan, let's start with you. I know we all love our narratives.
Yeah, so I'm very generally anti-narrative in the way I like to understand things. I think that the way MGoBlog, you know, analyzes things at the, you know, really micro level is the best way to really understand anything. But I think, you know, kind of unfortunately, it can be boiled down, on a macro level, it can be boiled down to a simple narrative. And that narrative is just coming up short consistently against rivals. Whether that means underperforming, you know, in the case of the Michigan State rivalry, and then just, you know, not even competing in terms of the Ohio State rivalry. But, you know, on a more micro level, I think that I don't think there's as quite as easy a narrative. I think a lot of the things that Jim Harbaugh has failed at have been, like, the kind of boring stuff that is not really fun to talk about or analyze. It's not even really on an X's and O's level. I just feel like there's a lot of there's just a lot of institutional, like, rot in the program under Harbaugh, in that I feel that he has just let certain things go by the wayside and not really had the level of attention to detail that you would hope, whether it's, you know, letting these gaping position holes open up on the roster for, you know, pretty inexplicable reasons, or just like kind of the way recruiting has been handled on and off, and, you know, just hiring assistants that seemed like bad ideas at the time and proved to be bad ideas in reality. So on the macro level, it's easy to say, like, yeah, look, he hasn't won enough games against his rivals. He hasn't won the Big Ten. He hasn't won the quote-unquote big game. On the micro level, I think the reason that that's happened is like a lot of very specific things, and it's just really making a lot of those like organizational and hiring mistakes again and again and again, to the point where you're just sort of always putting out fires over the past 6 years.
Yeah, I think at one level this is very simple. And I think I'm going with the narrative that, you know, I think Brian has embraced. I think AC are on board with it also, which is that Michigan made a good hire in Jim Harbaugh. He had a very good track record as a coach. There's no reason to do revisionist history about his time at Stanford or previous college stuff or his time in the NFL. And there's no need to do revisionist history about his, you know, the early part of his tenure at Michigan or at the good, about the good teams he's had. That he was a good coach who never tipped over into being one of those elite coaches who's a perennial college football playoff contender. That he could never get it done against Ohio State, and that there was definitely some bad luck in there, but ultimately, you know, over time it stops being luck. That he was a good coach who became a worse coach over time, and we're on the very much on the downslope now, and I don't know, you know, how long we've been on the downslope, but I think everything Dan said holds, and I could go on and on about all the details of what I think is wrong with the program, but I think ultimately it's about the decline of Jim Harbaugh and the way that the institution has, you know, abetted and allowed that decline, and the way that that radiates out across the coaching staff and the players and everything else. So the simple version is just you hire a good coach and he's pretty good, not as good as you want, and then he gets a little bit worse.
Yeah, no, I agree pretty much with everything both of you guys have said so far. And I mean, really for me, if you want to have a simple narrative to it, it's that there was a failure to modernize, both in terms of what we saw on the field in terms of schemes and which coaches they were bringing in. And also, you know, Don Brown, I would say much like Jim Harbaugh, was a very good coach who had lived up to his reputation for the first few years at Michigan. You know, he was keeping Michigan in those Ohio State games a lot of the times. And then as passing spreads and RPO spreads became more the way that college football went, the game sort of passed him by a bit in a way that it seems like it has with Harbaugh as well. And we've also seen, you know, we've discussed the recruiting disorganization. And I think some of that is, you know, we've seen it's kind of weird because people were talking about how cutting edge Michigan has been recruiting wise. And they kind of were for a time in terms of the satellite camps and, you know, kind of the way that they were branding the program, you know, the Europe trips and stuff like that. But a lot of the just simple, like, do you have your recruiting staff organized? Are you locking down your own home state? Are you competing with your main rival for prospects? Like that stuff, even when it was going well for Michigan as a program, never seemed to totally be clicking. So it always felt a little rickety at times, even though we were hoping it would ramp up into something better. And the last couple of years, it's just been laid bare just how far behind this staff has fallen, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, yep. I know we're supposed to do these fast. I just want to jump in and add, I completely agree about Brown. I want to defend Brown now that his days are probably numbered at Michigan. Dude almost, you know, won a couple of Ohio State games, you know, kind of by himself, especially in 2017.
Yeah.
He was a phenomenal DC with a really great legacy as a DC. And, you know, he's just not anymore. He's not an elite DC anymore. And that's just the passage of time and what happens to anyone in any field, especially a field as competitive as coaching. And I also want to say the thing about Harbaugh is that's been frustrating up until now was he just never tipped over into being anywhere near bad enough for his job to be threatened. And part of that is recruiting. It was disorganized, but like Michigan is still recruited pretty well with notable exceptions of cornerbacks and defensive tackles. And so I don't feel the need to revise any of that stuff. I just think it's like, you know, it was never quite good enough. And then you find yourself sliding off, you know, the face of the ice slowly and then very fast.
Yeah. And I'll, again, I know we're trying to keep this quick, but I will just also add that I feel that, you know, just because it didn't work doesn't mean it was the wrong thing to do. You know, you go back, like, if we could go back and roll the dice again in 2014 when we were doing this coaching search, I mean, you know, Michigan's backup option looks like it might have ended up being the right call. You know, Dan Mullen looks like he's got something going at Florida, and maybe he was, you know, he's going to end up being the better coach in the long run. But given what we knew in 2014 and given the data that we had, I mean, Jim Harbaugh was the slam dunk hire. You do it a million times out of a million. And just because it didn't work out to the extent that we all wanted it to doesn't mean that, you know, it was a mistake and that everything that Harbaugh has done will be invalidated, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that, like you said, the tougher thing was more that it didn't dip to a point disappointing enough where you could really pull the ripcord on it. And so we've had kind of this 6 year, I mean, 2016 kicked ass. We should not, you know, revise that out. And 2015 was a nice ramp up year. 2017 was largely marred by injury, and 2018 certainly had its moments. So I mean, this was not the all around disaster that some people are going to paint it as. It is definitely more complex than the narrative is going to be. Certainly coming out of some national media voices, I would say, to maybe unfairly oversimplify, but y'all know what I mean. It is both an easy narrative in terms of just time kind of ran out on this particular leadership group, and also college football is this extremely complicated thing with a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes, and it's tough to pin any coaching failure on any one thing. And with that, we're going to take a break and start looking ahead.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
I know exactly where I was when I first saw you, the way I see you now through these eyes, waiting to retry. Those pristine days I recall so fondly, so few are the trials when a life isn't lonely. And now if only I never felt it, I never heard it. I know I loved you, did I even deserve it when you returned it? There's no suspicion, no hesitation, believing through the eyes of sure adoration. Witness it now.
All right, we're going to open this segment with another wonderfully open-ended coaching question that starts a little specific because it's a response to the roundtable that was posted the day we're recording this. So this initial part is directed straight at me. You mentioned Chris Creighton as an option in today's This Week's Obsession. That's easy to roll off the tongue. And he's an under-the-radar coaching option that I'm very intrigued by. Can a program turnaround guy like Creighton translate to Michigan? Does he know how to win when he actually has talent? I guess, generally, what coach type should Michigan be looking for? And that is from at Leftist Lieutenant. I don't really want to necessarily address the Creighton thing as much initially as just I'm going to get my thoughts on the coach type thing out of the way while I just have them in my head and I'm talking. I don't think Michigan should specifically be looking for a type. I think they maybe should have a couple different archetypes in mind, but if college football has shown us anything, it's that there, it, first of all, it's hard to predict this stuff. And second of all, you can get to the same point in a number of different ways. You know, Clemson is a football power after elevating a little-known wide receiver coach as an interim guy, rolling with it when it started to look okay, having some patience, and then things totally blowing up in a way that was impossible to predict at the time. The other power hired a dude out of the NFL who everybody knew was a great college coach. It's hard to figure out. You know, some scheme guys work out great when they get elevated. Some, you know, scheme guys clearly should be topping out at the coordinator level. Some program turnaround guys translate to a higher level because they can they'd seamlessly slip into the talent aspect of it and really know how to coach. Some of them don't know how to handle being at a big program and recruiting at that level, and it's really difficult to predict this stuff, and trying to predict this stuff involves getting into some deeply boring weeds too a lot of the time. So that's my thoughts on kind of the type. Is I don't think they should be looking for one necessarily. Do either of you guys have, like, I guess Dan, I'll start with you, because I think you've, when we've had our private conversations, you've mentioned a preference for one side of the ball. So is there a type that you're looking for?
I mean, okay. So as far as, you know, a side of the ball, I mean, yeah, I'm looking for an offensive guy. I just think most great coaches in the, both the NFL and college right now are offensive guys. The game is an offensive game. And I think that you tend to get defensive guys, you know, even great ones like, well, not great head coaches, but great defensive coordinators like Pat Narduzzi, or, you know, whoever you want to go with. And they end up being more conservative head coaches, which, you know, is generally the wrong call. You know, whether it's going for it on fourth down or running a more wide open offense, you know, I just generally do want a guy with an offensive background. Now, that said, like, I want to kind of also talk about it and build on what Ace was talking about. Like, there is nobody... I'm gonna try my best not to go on a bigger rant here, just because, like, there's two steps to this, right? There's, do you want to keep Jim Harbaugh, and then there's, who do you want to get to replace him? I personally feel as though I have seen more than enough over the past 6 years to say, you know, we know what Jim Harbaugh is. We know it's not working. I don't see any reason that I think it would really get better. That brings me to the point that, like, yeah, I think Michigan should move on from him. I don't, you know, and I'm not going to spend time relitigating that because I think we've made our feelings very clear about it. But then I bring that up to say that doesn't mean that I have the perfect head coach lined up that, like, I know is going to be better than Jim Harbaugh. Okay, like, this is, like Ace said, this is a really hard thing to predict, and predicting it really, like, you know, means getting down into a lot of really, like, tough weeds. And you know, like, is it a guarantee that whether it's, you know, Chris Creighton or Matt Campbell or whoever that has had success with less talented guys, you know, do we know that what they're going to do with NFL talent? No, we don't. But there is no Urban Meyer out there, guys. Like, there's no, like, surefire, absolutely, like, knock it out of the park, home run hire. Outside of maybe one or two guys that Michigan probably can't get.
Like Urban Meyer.
Like Urban Meyer, exactly. And so, like, yeah, there's not going to be a guy that I know will work. What we can do is we can look at the data we have available, and we can say, like, you know, based on, you know, based on that data, like, what do we project this to be, you know, a feasible replacement that has the potential to elevate this, you know, program from where it's been? And you just don't, that can come from anywhere. You just don't know. I mean, guys like, I don't know, like, there's successful coaches that have come up through the ranks of like high school football and then into like D3 and been totally obscure for years and then made their way and onto the big stage and made the most of it. I have one of my best friends from childhood is in, you know, is in the coaching business right now. You know, he went through the GA process and then, you know, like, he's currently on, you know, an NFL staff as, you know, like a quality control guy. And he's just told me, he's like, it's insane. And you don't know when you're going to get your shot. And people come from everywhere. So there is no archetype besides I want a guy that, like, you know, has an offensive background and, you know, like, generally knows where the game is going and, you know, has shown the ability to adapt and to, you know, stay on the cutting edge of things. So that's my very long answer to that question.
Yeah, I mean, that's very cogent. I do have a stronger opinion on this than either of you, I think. First of all, I take it we're opening that can of soup here after I answer this question, right? So I won't go to that yet.
That's fair, yeah.
I'll leave the can of soup alone right now. But, you know, I will say this. I do think that what Michigan specifically needs are coaches that are used to playing as extreme underdogs in Power 5 situations. Coaches who have shown the ability to win games in Power 5 conferences, routinely playing against teams that are loaded with blue chips when they don't have that. And so everything that they're doing schematically, they're hiring assistants, they're putting together game plans, they're training their players to try to beat teams that should be better. And I say that because the task in front of Michigan is to try to beat teams that do not have the talent gap of like Alabama versus Vanderbilt, but we know there's a talent gap with Ohio State. And one of the main failures of the Harbaugh era is a refusal to confront that smartly and build your team around that reality. So yeah, I want guys that have gone to war, you know, week in, week out in tough conferences and have shown they can, if not, you know, get the huge upset every time, they can at least keep it respectable. They can be a thorn in the side of these programs and they can beat teams that, you know, right on the edge of what they should supposed to be beat and get upset sometimes. That's where I'm at.
Well, I think that perfectly gets to the guy we've been bandying about in
soup,
our in
soup,
our private
soup,
conversation.
Soup.
There it is. So Matt Campbell of Iowa State. I was not at all expecting to like him as much as a candidate as I have the more I have learned about him. And there's a few different things that make him pretty enticing. One is what Connor was getting at in terms of, you know, Campbell has been coaching at Iowa State, a program that has traditionally sucked ass in a conference that, you know, maybe isn't at the very tip top of college football, but certainly generally throws teams that are traditionally better than Iowa State out there on a pretty regular basis. So Campbell's had a lot of uphill climbing to do, both in terms of what he took over and what he has to play against. He's sprung some upsets against Oklahoma and generally been a just thorn in that team's side, despite the fact that they are otherwise pretty unstoppable in that conference right now. He has recruited above what Iowa State was doing historically in the years heading into his tenure, which and has even landed a couple 4-stars, which considering the recruiting environment that he is dealing with there is remarkably impressive. He's a Toledo and Mount Union and generally Ohio guy who does not have strong Ohio State ties, which sounds wonderful in terms of recruiting that area, knowing that area, having connection to that area. He is a Mount Union guy. Mount Union is, if you don't know about them, that is the class of Division III by so much. It's insane. They have a coaching tree that is legitimately better than Michigan's. Ed Warner is also from there. So you might even be able to have a holdover with maybe the best offensive line coach in the country. I'm sorry to kind of like throw out all the things we've been saying and maybe dominate this segment a little bit, but Campbell sounds great to me all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, I know Dan's bursting at the seams here, but I want to say this morning, this came up in our group chat, and I said, you guys are going to have to talk me into this Matt Campbell hype. I keep hearing his name. I feel like people are charmed by him, but like, what does it mean to go, 7-5 at Iowa State? Like, who cares, right? But then we looked at it, and his conference record, sort of in non-transition years, is very good. He's at a team that is probably one of, if not the very worst historically among like all Power Five conferences. I mean, they're a nothing program historically, right? He's up there recruiting measurably. You can see it when you look at the numbers. And he's been innovative with scheme. And the last thing I want to say is, when you find an elite football coach from Ohio who has no like inherent love or connections to Ohio State, the juju there is very, very good if you're Michigan. That's the origin of Bo and a lot of other great figures in Michigan history. I feel like this guy's a unicorn that Michigan should snatch up as soon as they can.
And he's 40 years old. That you mentioned one thing I forgot to mention, which is he has been, shall we say, scheme forward, including on defense where they've, run some stuff that is actually designed to stop the modern passing RPO spreads, which I'm interested in that now. I'm very interested in that. and the fact that he's 40, is something I forgot to mention when discussing kind of the type thing is that, one thing about the lack of obvious candidates is that obvious candidates tend to be, it's hard to find an obvious candidate who is in their prime, because those guys stick around wherever they're at or they move to the NFL. So I would rather shoot for a younger guy because I would rather catch the come up than the come down. And we've seen at Michigan what happens when you catch the come down, both in terms of like what we experienced in the last few years of Lloyd Carr's tenure, when you just see what happens when a coach is winding down. And then, with Jim Harbaugh getting a guy who had had great success elsewhere, started off with great success, and then both in terms of him and at least one of his coordinators, the game kind of moved past them at an alarming speed.
Yeah, and I'll add on to that. I'll say that the main argument that I've heard against Matt Campbell is that like he's gotten upset sometimes, and his team comes out flat occasionally. And for that second point, I have some bad news for you about Jim Harbaugh, whose teams famously never come out completely flat. But, I mean, as far as, like, getting upset, guys, we're still talking about Iowa State here. Like, I don't consider it getting – like, the fact that Iowa State is a favorite in games and is even in the position to get upset is a tribute to – or is, a
– Tribute is fine.
Whatever. Tribute, yeah, you know what, it's a tribute, whatever, that's cool. It's a tribute to their staff. And, quite frankly, I mean, look, again, is Matt Campbell perfect? No, like, I'm not saying Matt Campbell's perfect. But, like, I think there's, if you're looking for a guy, you're looking for that, those indicators that he might be able to get to that point of being an elite coach, I think it's all there. I mean, he's increased their recruiting, he's young, he's hungry. This is a guy that took a look at like the state of modern college offenses and decided to, basically invent the, or, not him personally, but his staff, invent the 404 type, and, bring in a ton of linebackers and hybrid players to try to screw up the quarterback's reads and stop a lot of that, spread to pass offense. I don't see – yeah, he's absolutely, someone that should be on the top of Michigan's list. He's a Midwest guy. That's – he's a very strong candidate. I don't know what else to say about him.
And he also, you know, actually seems attainable as opposed to some of the names that people have thrown out, including me. You know, I you know, have been somewhat half-jokingly throwing out Joe Brady and Eric Bieniemy to NFL coordinators. And first of all, I don't think there's a chance there. I would love either of them, especially Bieniemy. It's just probably not going to happen. I do want to give some further context to Matt Campbell's success at Iowa State compared to historical norms. He had 8-win seasons in both 2017 and 2018 after taking over a 3-win program. The last time they won at least 8 games in a season prior to that was 2000. And the time before that was 1978 when they were in the Big Eight.
Wow.
And that was at 1978. They had that capped off a run of 3 straight seasons with 8 wins. That is the last time before Matt Campbell that they had consecutive 8-win seasons. So, I would say Campbell has really outperformed what you would normally expect somebody to do at Iowa State, especially without having a guy like Seneca Wallace, who was kind of the last dude to really insert any sort of energy into that program. Campbell hasn't really had that, like, program-altering talent at quarterback where you can maybe somewhat artificially boost how strong your program looks when you're moving from being real bad to just being competitive. Instead, he's done that by just really strengthening the program in ways that seem pretty sustainable. Do we want to throw out any other names now that we have praised Matt Campbell up, down, and sideways, or are we just now just wholly on the Matt Campbell train?
I would say I don't want to throw out this name, but I will address I think the biggest slam dunk hire that Michigan could hire is Luke Fickell. Now, the biggest, you know, Luke Fickell, I mean, I don't need to really tell you about it, but, like, he's got Cincinnati playing at a top 10 level right now. I'm not sure they're actually top 10, but they're very, very good. He's built that program up from the ground up. He's a Midwest guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He'd be perfect. Now, the biggest problem with Luke Fickell is that he seems to be a diehard Ohio State Buckeye fan. And to the point where it's like he almost couldn't even, I wouldn't even, like, trust him. Even how good of a coach he is, I wouldn't want him to be the head coach of Michigan. I just don't think it's, like, a culture fit when you're that dedicated to, you know, Ohio State. And I'm not even really, like, a huge culture guy. I tend to believe that, you know, winning pretty much solves culture issues. But you can't be a diehard fan of you know, Michigan's biggest rival. Other than him, I'd say I'd be generally wouldn't necessarily want to go NFL coordinator route because those guys are always looking to get back into the NFL at the first, you know, at their first opportunity. If they were going to go, you know, a college coordinator route, it better be like an elite college coordinator. Like, I don't know if Brett Venables would even work, but a Brett Venables level guy. Venables feels like a Southern guy. He feels like he's almost waiting to be, you know.
And his kids are at Clemson, and they're just starting their careers. So, I mean, he's at least there through however long those kids have eligibility.
Right. So I'm not even, like, throwing out the name. I'm just addressing some names that I've heard brought up. You know, you brought up Chris Creighton. I think, you know, that's a guy that you could – maybe he's a guy that you look at if this next coach doesn't work. Just because I'm not sure if he's, you know, qualified quite yet. You know, is what he's done at Eastern is impressive, but, like, is he ready to take over, a whole different beast of a program? You know, not sure if I'm ready to say that yet. But, you know, and look, I haven't done an exhaustive search, but those are just some of the names that have thrown up, that have been, you know, thrown out, and those are my general thoughts on them.
Thrown up seemed like an appropriate way to put it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
A guy like Chris Creighton, to me, that's, you're taking a pretty big risk. I don't think a guy like that is quite proven enough yet, you know, to be hired as head coach at Michigan. Fickell, man, I'm the vibes guy, right? I get some real bad vibes from that dude. Like, he coaches, we've heard that Luke Fickell, you know, he coaches with a Buckeye over his heart, like a religious medal. Like, that's just, first of all, that's just freaky. For a guy who's not coaching at Ohio State, that's just freakish behavior. It unnerves me. And I don't want anybody who's that diehard of a Buckeye and like treats it like a religion to be coaching Michigan. I'm sorry if that makes me like a Bo Schembechler Michigan man diehard. I promise you I'm not. I don't care if it's a Michigan man. I just don't need a Buckeye in this job. I'm totally in the bag for Coach Soup, as I'm calling him. I want that soup. You know, it's going to be a cold winter. We need some warm soup around here. That's what I say.
Yeah, I agree that both Fickell might be an odd fit, and also, from what I've heard, might not even be a particularly realistic candidate. It's possible that, given his strong Catholic ties, that he's actually holding out for the Notre Dame job to open up as well as the Ohio State job, and that Michigan would not really be something he'd be interested in if it precludes him from being able to jump to one of those schools. And honestly, if that's part of the thought process, then Michigan shouldn't be hiring that guy anyway. I think we're all in agreement on Soup.
I'll throw out one more name. I would say Campbell would be my first choice, but I will throw out Chris Klieman, the current head coach of Kansas State, North Dakota State head coach for, he's part of the North Dakota State tree. He was their defensive backs coach and then their defensive coordinator and then their head coach for 4 years before moving to Kansas State. Kind of same deal. Like, Kansas State, a little bit better program than Iowa State, but, you know, has had success there. Seems to be kind of an up-and-comer. But I would choose Campbell over him. So, just another name.
Yeah, and I should clarify that Creighton, for me, is definitely like a backup plan, possibly to the backup plan, but I think if you miss on your main guys, then somebody who has turned Eastern Michigan into a team that is winning, you know, 5, 6, 7 games a year and occasionally beating a Power 5 team or putting a scare into one, you can do worse. And Michigan has in the past, in the very recent past. and with that, we're going to move on to other football mailbag questions and our Big Ten picks. All right, we're going to start with one that we'll see how long this remains relevant. From @zspot729, do you think Gattis is not in control of all the play calling this year? I'm curious because Josh would just go with what was hot in games last year. For example, running the ball against all day against Illinois, passing more against Indiana last year. Dan, let's start with you.
I just don't know what to say. The Josh Gattis offense has looked so different from game to game. You know, we all thought he had it figured out coming from last year and then into this year with the Minnesota game, that, you know, this was really what speed and safe space was supposed to look like. But, I mean, we saw, for the first couple games of 2019, like, I'll just go through it quickly. Like, you had Middle Tennessee State, complete mess, like, a whole grab bag of things that didn't really make sense together. Army, you know, just running the ball into a brick wall all day with zero reads. Wisconsin, the debacle. Illinois, you know, they're like running the ball all the time. You finally get to Penn State and they like start to do just bubbles all the time. And then again, it's like running the ball all day against Notre Dame. And then like sort of passing spreads against Ohio State and Alabama. And then you start this year off and it's like all screens, all quarterback run against Minnesota. Then Michigan State is like a pro style from the pistol, and Indiana is, you know, I don't know. They couldn't run the ball at all, so I don't even know if it's fair to say, but they just all, again, sort of like a passing spread. So, like, I don't know. What is the Josh Gattis offense? I have no idea what Josh Gattis wants to run. So, like, is Harbaugh involved in that? I'm sure he is to a certain extent. I'm sure he's meddling to a certain extent. But I don't, like, is there any real evidence that Josh Gattis, like, has a coherent offensive philosophy at this point? I mean, we thought it was going to be, like, all reads all the time, all screens, all speed and space all the time. And, like, we've only seen that in bits and spurts. I don't know. It's hard to say. I literally have no idea. And that's a tough thing to say about an offensive coordinator that's, like, you know, almost a year and a half in.
Yeah, I mean, I'll keep this short. I've tried to defend Gattis. I do suspect there's some Harbaugh meddling going on, and that's part of the dysfunctionality of the program. But I just also don't know what to say when I know Minnesota's bad, but if you just kept running the playbook you had against Minnesota, I don't know if you would have beaten Indiana, but you probably would have beaten Michigan State. Should have, and they obviously should have won that game. I don't know. I would love to believe in Gattis, but whatever's going on there in terms of who's putting these plans together and how the calls are being made is just so broken that, yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I have to add to that is that, I mean, Gattis is certainly not blameless. At the same time, Harbaugh, you know, we've been talking about kind of inexplicable, inconsistent game plans for years, or at least since Jed Fish left. And things kind of became a muddled mess in the offensive coaching staff where there wasn't a clear hierarchy. And the constant there has been Jim Harbaugh. Next question. We flip to the other side of the ball for more depressing stuff. From at Reed McCarthy. Can we finally admit that the defensive transfers and lack of recent defensive recruiting success point towards some major problem with Don Brown? We are getting offensive players we need, but whiffing all over the place on defense. Connor, let's start with you.
I mean, we knew Don Brown was not like an ace recruiter. We knew that he would get whoever he wanted from the Northeast, or New England specifically, and he has. And some of those guys have been good. Yeah. Woo. Some of those guys have been very good, I would add, by the way. Like Quiddy Pay, that's a home run, you know, grand slam dinger of a recruiting success, for instance.
Yeah, I shouldn't belittle the Northeast like that. Sorry.
No, I mean, you know, it's been good for Michigan to lock that down. But
yeah, don't you dare belittle the Northeast like that, by the way.
But, like, no, I don't think it's a – I don't see that in those terms as a Don Brown problem. Obviously, we think Don Brown has been passed schematically and that he's part of the problem of Michigan not assessing its talent correctly and adjusting to what it actually has on its roster. But one of the basic problems Michigan has is you can have a coordinator who's not an ace recruiter. He just needs assistants who are ace recruiters, and Michigan hasn't done good enough job filling in those spots. Nua has been a disappointment. We knew Zordich wasn't an ace recruiter, and we've forgiven him because he had great cornerbacks until apparently not. So no, I don't see this as Don Brown's problem. I think that stuff, what we're seeing now are the fruits of the dysfunctionality of the entire ecosystem in Michigan.
I'll take a little bit of a deviation there. I actually think it is a little bit of a Don Brown problem in terms of philosophy. I mean, look, Don Brown is this guy that came from Boston College, and his big, you know, thing was like pulling absolute like freaks out of, you know, random schools in Rhode Island. And for the most, like, that has worked very well for a lot of positions, namely, you know, tight ends. It has worked for his defensive ends. He's found great linebackers, not necessarily in the Northeast, but he's done a really good job recruiting linebackers. You know, but to a certain extent, like, I do think Don Brown and maybe this defensive staff as a whole, you know, I think have been given a lot of autonomy by Coach Harbaugh. And I think that a lot of that is what they have done with that is decided to go after guys that, you know, fit just a certain mold. And that has led to our current, like, you know, the 2018 class of, like, super tall corners that couldn't run. And, Now a couple classes in a row with, you know, I guess 2019 class aside, with Hinton and Mozzie Smith, you know, the 2020 and 2021 classes that seem to have no true defensive tackles in them. It just feels like there are certain things that Don Brown does not value. And, you know, I'm not like a scout. I couldn't really like go in depth on it, but it does feel like the recruiting focus on the defensive side of the ball misses in a few key areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with what you're both getting at, and I think it kind of like a lot of it just depends on whether you want to place the blame with the recruiting focus on Don Brown for taking that autonomy and using it the way he has, or with Jim Harbaugh for giving him that autonomy instead of going, hey man, maybe start recruiting like you're at a blue blood instead of Boston College. I would say it's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly I would say more of it is just part of the overarching program issues, but the overarching program issues also involve, you know, Don Brown is a prominent part of that. So it's kind of a tough thing to separate out. The next question, I think, will be pretty quick. I'm not even going to attempt this Twitter handle. Where do you think this team ranks in the Big Ten in terms of raw talent, despite clear shortcomings at a few positions? I struggle to think of anyone, save Ohio State and maybe Wisconsin, obviously more talented. Does that make you more optimistic for next year, either under Harbaugh or otherwise? Dan, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, this team is just as talented. I'll say, like, top to bottom, they're probably a little bit less talented than Penn State, just because Penn State has, you know, like, a pretty complete defense, even though Penn State sucks this year. I think that's mostly due to just, you know, their quarterback, and just maybe, like, you know, coaching in general. But I'll say that they're right below Penn State, if not just, like, on par with Penn State. Obviously a step below Ohio State. And, you know, like a half step above Wisconsin. The problem is not what Michigan has. The problem is what Michigan doesn't have. They have allowed, you know, and then there's a broken record at this point, so I won't go too in-depth, but they've allowed these gaping position gaps to open up at cornerback and at defensive tackle. And it doesn't matter how good Cam McGrone is or how good Josh Ross is or how good, you know, Paye or Hutchinson are or Dax Hill, like, if you don't have it, like, your corners have to play and your defensive tackles have to play. And if your opponent can just, you know, spam one play and take advantage of your, you know, extremely weak position group, none of the rest of the stuff matters. On a macro level, this team is, you know, right up there with Penn State and, you know, a step below Ohio State. On a, like, position by position level, there are huge gaps where, like, Michigan's defensive tackles are probably worse than, like, most of the conference. Michigan's cornerbacks are certainly worse than most of the conference, and that's what is weighing this team down.
Yeah, I mean, I have the Seth hot take, which is the defensive tackles haven't been that disastrous this year. It's just they're not, you know, they're not that great. But regardless, I agree with Dan. I think Michigan is exactly on par with Penn State. I think the talent, you know, gap there might get overstated a little bit, especially given that Michigan has way more upside right now in their offense than Penn State does. Obviously, below OSU, more talent than Wisconsin, except for, you know, offensive line and maybe a couple other positions. But yeah, I mean, the message I want to leave people with here is, like, Michigan has so much talent on their roster. Whoever is the next coach will definitely have plenty of talent. And just bear this in mind. Any other cornerback you like in the Big Ten who doesn't play for Ohio State or Penn State, 95% of those guys would have come to Michigan if they'd been recruited by Michigan. And that's the most damning thing here.
Yeah. I mean, just to add to what you guys have said, if you want to just use an objective breakdown, 247 does have, it's not perfect, but they take the recruiting rankings of guys who are still on the roster and throw it into their formula. They don't weight it by year, which is the only thing that I kind of quibble with on it, but as a way of just measuring raw team talent, it's a nice way of just getting a general idea. Ohio State's third in the country. They're in the Georgia, Alabama, Clemson tier. And in fact, in front of Clemson by a decent amount. Penn State is second in the conference and 13th in the country. Michigan is 17th in the country, third in the conference. Pretty much a relatively negligible difference with Penn State in terms of roster talent. And then after that, there's a pretty big drop-off in terms of points before you get to Nebraska, which is the next Big Ten team that pops up at 24, and then Wisconsin at 27. So Michigan is very much in that upper tier, like you guys have been saying. This isn't a talent problem. And just to address the second part of the question, it definitely makes me optimistic for a coach stepping in. I'm going to just go with the coach stepping in after Harbaugh, not addressing the part where it might still be Jim Harbaugh, because then it'll be more of the same. But it absolutely makes the program more enticing. And it is a situation where hopefully, I mean, there are holes to fill, but I expect there to be a very, very active transfer market, including a grad transfer market this offseason, given that it's just going to be a mess with people being keeping their eligibility from this year and teams still trying to fit in a recruiting class and a scholarship cap and keep, if there is one, and keep players happy with where they are on the depth chart, which is probably going to be the bigger problem. So hopefully Michigan can bring in a coach who can either bring in some guys from the program he's at or hit the grad transfer market pretty hard and patch some holes until the new coach is able to do it through recruiting. The next question comes from there are so many Bryants, a Brian via email. Well, I realize that Harbaugh leaving after the season is probably likely. Should the strength of the 2021 recruiting class, particularly J.J. McCarthy, have any effect on whether Michigan keeps him or not? Maybe I'm overvaluing him, but I would hate to see J.J. leave if Harbaugh, Gattis are both gone. Thank you for reading. Hope you are well. We're going to say that applies to everybody. Connor, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as Dan knows, you know, Dan and I spent so many months of this year like researching and talking about this recruiting class, and I would definitely hate to lose some of them. That would actually make me very sad in a way that losing these games hasn't. I think a lot of them would still want to come, especially if Michigan is bringing in an exciting new coach. And I also think McCarthy actually is one of the most solid commits on that list, because he is that kind of kid who, you know, God love him, for whatever reason, really, really wants to come to Michigan and just loves the whole deal. And he's a Midwestern kid, and he's been rock solid and kind of trying to lead recruiting, you know, from the recruit standpoint for Michigan this whole time. So it would be a little bit shocking to me if he decided to leave. I think it would be a disaster if he decided to leave, though, because he is very talented and Michigan's lucky to have him. But I feel okay about that one.
Yeah, I mean, you can't not fire a coach because you're worried about a recruiting class. Because the only thing that's worse than a transition class, which, you know, look, I'm sure that we would absolutely lose a ton of these 2021 kids if Harbaugh was fired. That's just what's going to happen. That's what happened when Hoke was fired, you know, etc. But you can't not fire a coach because you're afraid of that, because, look, the recruiting is also already kind of starting to take a downward turn. If things continue to go the way they are going right now, and Michigan's staring down the barrel of, like, 2-6, which doesn't seem totally off the table, you're going to, like, they've already lost Rayshon Benny, who, you know, was probably going to commit to Michigan if they didn't lose to Michigan State. You're looking at losing a couple other kids in state, and, you know, like, you're looking at potentially losing Donovan Edwards, whatever. I mean, these are specific recruits. But the point is, that's only going to get worse if, like, next year Harbaugh is, like, coaching for his job or whatever. You know, like, they're not going to be able to recruit well next year. So then you're looking at, like, tanking both the 2021 class and the 2022 class because you wanted to make sure you got J.J. McCarthy. And then all of a sudden you end up with the next coach in 2022 really having, like, half of the roster be made up of, like, subpar recruits. So You need to rip the Band-Aid off, so to speak, and just live with the fact that, like, I mean, look, this is the perfect year to have a transition class. Everyone on this roster can come back again if they want to. So, like, have a transition class now, and then, like, let the new guy come in and hit the ground running, is my opinion.
Yeah, I am totally in agreement in terms of recruiting, if anything, should be a reason to move on faster, not slower. Obviously, losing a five-star quarterback potentially would be not good. But at the same time, you can maybe cover again for quarterback with a grad transfer while you're picking your guy. And there is no guarantee that McCarthy, as much as we said, he's Michigan through and through and might make it through a coaching transition even. Especially given he might make it through a coaching transition, that hopefully adds some optimism to the program. You don't want to risk losing him because there's just, the rest of the class is falling apart. And, there's a chance you lose him that way. So I think certainly you don't hold on to a coach for a recruiting class, and especially not for one specific recruit. And it's not like this is a top five class.
By the way, I failed to answer the question, which is, yeah, like, firing Harbaugh is a consideration beyond recruiting. I just said a lot of nice things about JJ McCarthy, but that does not change my opinion about firing Harbaugh.
Good to get that in there. This one is from our friend Jason Blankenship. Not sure this is a question, but for years I've said that one guy I wanted Harbaugh to have been able to coach was poor damn Devin Gardner. So when we got Milton as quarterback, monkey's paw finger curls. Apparently this is my fault. So we've been exonerated. It is actually our sponsor's fault. I just want to get that out of the way. So I guess actually partially our fault, but not us specifically. And
look, we are just doing what the man tells us to do. He gives us a script before every podcast that we follow to a T. This is all pre-scripted, and none of these are our original ideas, so it is entirely his fault.
Yeah, I mean, it should be pretty easy to tell if you go back and listen how scripted the show is. We are just passengers in this vessel.
Exactly.
Last mailbag question before we get to our Big Ten picks. And I'm interested to hear your guys' answers because you live in different places than I do and can't just, like, go to games. What's your favorite non-football or men's basketball Michigan teams to follow?
Oh, gosh. That's a good question. I guess the baseball team last year was really fun. I gotta be honest, it's tough. Like, when I was a student a couple of years ago, basketball and, I'm a diehard football fan, so everything else just kind of, like, pales in comparison. I would say the one that that I usually get into, most summers when there's nothing else on, is a softball team. And they're, like, Michigan is, like, the Alabama of softball. And, That sport rocks, and it's, like, super fast-paced, dirt infield. The pitching is really cool to watch. It's just, like, a really impressive game, like, genuinely. And I'm not saying that in, like, any kind of pandering way at all. It's really fun to watch, and I find it very impressive, and they're very, very good at it.
Yeah, you've caught me red-handed here. I really don't follow many college sports besides football and basketball.
This was an unfair question to ask Connor because he's not even a Michigan basketball guy.
Oh, okay.
Do not say who okay. He roots for. We're gonna.
We can't go. We can't go too deep into that.
I won't put you out there. I won't put you out there.
I will say I agree with Dan. Actually, I had fun following baseball a little bit last year, and also softball. Softball is one that, like, when that's in its postseason, it's actually on TV. You see Michigan cropping up all the time. And it's always a really fun sport to watch. In fact, in some ways, women's softball, like, in some ways can be more fun than baseball. It sometimes feels more dynamic. So yeah, that's definitely a good pick.
Oh, yeah, I would absolutely pick straight up. I'm more entertained by softball than college baseball. It moves faster, for one thing. And, the tight quarters of it make it really interesting. And it also adds a fair amount of strategy to it, whereas college baseball is hit dingers with aluminum bats. But I mean, I very much enjoyed Michigan's run last year, do not get me wrong, on the baseball side of things. I'm not surprised by your answers because it's just really hard to keep up with non-revenue sports when you're not in, like, the immediate footprint of a school. Unless you're making a really concerted effort to, like, go out of your way and watch BTN Plus and stuff like that. And also, the BTN Plus streaming service kind of sucks. So, that is also an impediment. I have learned this in part because I've been making a concerted effort to get into the women's basketball team, which I find extremely fun. They're getting really good. Naz Hillman might be the best player that Michigan has ever had in that program. But it can be difficult to catch the game sometimes until it gets to the postseason. So trying to keep up with it, even when you're in the footprint. And I've gone to a women's game in person within the last few years, and that's also a really fun experience. It's definitely very different and more, I would say, kind of laid back and family geared than a men's basketball game. But there's a lot of that I really like, where it's not like this intense kind of overwhelming entertainment experience. And it's got a little bit more of a baseball game feel to it, but also the fans are still very passionate and into it when the games get tight. So now that we've done that, we are going to swing right back around to football, do our Big Ten picks for this week, and we're going to start off with the rare Big Ten Friday night game. Iowa travels to Minnesota. They are favored by 3.5, over under of 58. This actually opened as a pick'em because apparently people weren't watching football last week. And the over-under was a much lower 53.5. Dan, who you got here?
I'm going to keep betting from just a value perspective on Minnesota. Because I think that they are a very flawed team with an absolute, you know, crap defense. But I'm going to say, like, they've got that explosive offense. It's a really good matchup with Iowa's cover two zone scheme. It's, you know, the RPO matches up really well with teams that just exclusively, you know, play zone. So yeah, give me Minnesota, and, you know, for the sake of value, give me Minnesota money line.
I like Minnesota. I know their defense is horrific, but I don't think they're as bad as a team as they appeared to be, in their first 2 weeks. And yeah, I like the value here of taking them. I'm also taking, the over. That seems low for me, given that Iowa just hung 49 on Michigan State, and we know Minnesota can score a lot.
I'm going to split my going with and going against the public thing here. Normally I like going against, and this line has been flying in Iowa's direction, obviously, but I think that's for very good reason, which is that Minnesota is very bad and Iowa is competent. So I am taking Iowa to cover here, and I am also taking the under, which is going against the public, considering that has flown up 5.5 points. This is still a game that involves Iowa. I think last week against Michigan State was a bit of a mirage with some special teams and defensive touchdowns coming into play there. I'm not sold on Minnesota's offense. I am somewhat sold on Iowa's defense. But this is still an Iowa game, so give me Iowa in the under. Our next matchup is on Saturday at noon. Indiana favored by 7.5 at Michigan State, over under 52. This opened with Indiana favored by 9, so it slid slightly in Michigan State's direction, and the total has come down 5.5 points from 57.5. Dan, your pick?
Give me I'm going to go with the over. That's my biggest pick. I think I'm going to go over 52. I think I'll take Indiana to cover. I think Michigan State showed more of what they actually are last week. You know, now that we know that Michigan is bad, I think that, like, my Michigan State is bad takes are, you know, are now, like, standing up. And it's unfortunate that this, you know, Michigan team, as bad as it is, couldn't just beat Michigan State, because then I could have much more fun with them, you know, being abject this year. Unfortunately, you know, this Michigan State team could potentially go, like, 1-7 with one win being against Michigan, which would, you know, be, like, the worst possible life for me to live. But I will go Indiana to cover.
I think Indiana is going to beat the brakes off these guys, because Michigan State is terrible. They're actually very bad. I like the over. I'm always attracted to overs. What can I say?
This season is designed to make Michigan fans feel pain. Indiana covers easily. And I am also taking the over, because that is just a low point total. And Rocky Lombardi has been competent-ish. Last week was a
step
back.
Not against Iowa.
Last week was a big step back. I mean, I don't know.
They got unlucky. They need to have a middle of the road. I mean, I guess they didn't get lucky against Michigan, but they've been totally unlucky in their two losses. Now look, Iowa would have won it either way, but they've had a ton of turnovers against in their two losses. So if they have, like, average turnover luck, I guess, you know, they could probably cover.
You're still doing your Michigan State penance, I see.
Yeah, I have to. I spent the entire offseason shitting all over their entire roster. I mean, like, I don't know what to say. I've been owned. I have to, like, you know, I have to continue to act like they're good.
We're all up here, my friend. Yeah.
I forgot to mention this podcast's other sponsor, which is still the good Dr. Fanson. And with that, let's just move on. Illinois Rutgers, Jesus Christ. This is a football game. It's being played. Rutgers is favored by 6.5. Good Lord,
Jesus.
Illinois. With an over-under of 52, this opened with Rutgers favored by 7, so the line has sadly actually crept back in the Illini direction, and it opened with a disgusting total of 47.5. So the people are hoping this game is prettier than Vegas initially thought. Dan, who you got?
God, Illinois has been so bad. But are they 7 points worse than Rutgers? You know what? I'm going to go with Rutgers to cover. Rutgers has looked like they've got some fight this year. I mean, Rutgers might be like better than Michigan this year, genuinely. They beat Michigan State. They basically played Indiana the same way that we did. And they, you know, scored some points against Ohio State. So yeah, Rutgers covers. Gosh, that's going to be a really unfun night game in a couple weeks against Michigan.
Ugh, I forgot that was a night.
I mean, okay. I'm not going to say what I think about whether Rutgers is better than Michigan, because I don't want to curse us. But I do like Rutgers to cover, because of the many candidates in a bad year in the Big Ten, I think Illinois is the worst team. And like you said, Rutgers is showing some competency. I'm taking the under kind of for fun. I don't necessarily know how it's going to play out, but I feel like I should take at least one under. So,
yeah, I actually very much agree with the under, because first of all, look at the two teams involved. Second of all, Illinois has a COVID outbreak that is affecting their quarterback position, which is also why I am making it a clean sweep on us picking Rutgers to cover. Let's move on as quickly as possible before people record this. Penn State, I think this is a 3:30 game. Penn State and Nebraska, the Nittany Lions are favored by 3.5, total of 55.5. This opened with Penn State by 4, and in yet another example of the total moving by quite a bit, this opened at 62.5. Dan, any thoughts on this one?
Gosh, I don't know. This is kind of my, like, two trends where, like, I've been trying to bet on Nebraska, which has not worked out, because I feel like Nebraska's getting unfairly slandered this year. Well, fairly, but like from a football perspective, unfairly slandered. And then I also kind of feel like Penn State like has to win a game at some point. They're still very talented. Give me Penn State to cover. Penn State's a better team than Nebraska. That said, I mean, gosh, there's some problems at Penn State. They have looked horrendous on offense. Just in every game, basically. But yeah, give me Penn State to cover. That's not enough points. If they just like put something together, they can definitely blow out this team.
Connor, you got?
Oh yeah. I'm taking Nebraska to cover. I obviously hate Nebraska and love betting against them, but like Penn State's just been so bad, and yeah. So I mean, given that they're favorite, I'll take Nebraska to cover, and I'll take the over because that is another low over under.
Yeah, this one's tough. I'm kind of expecting this to be Penn State's week, but I also have a really hard time picking them when Sean Clifford has been this bad. So given that it is in Nebraska and they're getting the points, I'm going to take the points and go with Nebraska. And I'm going to stay away from that over-under because I'd be inclined to take the under if it was anywhere near that initial total. But that has been bet down substantially. So I would stay away from that one. Speaking of staying away from things, Ohio State, -25 at Maryland, with an over under of 72.5. This opened with the Buckeyes favored by 27 and a point total of 70.5. This all terrifies me. I would stay away from this game completely. But hypothetically, if we were to bet this one, Dan, who you got?
Maryland to cover. Maryland, after looking abject against Northwestern, Tua's looked very good. I think that they are genuinely like a pretty good offense. They've got some good receivers. Mike Locksley is running a pretty nice RPO system there. Ohio State's defense has struggled a little bit. Give me Maryland to cover, and then give me the under. That's just a really high over-under. I feel like Ohio State has a couple of times this year gotten into, like, turtle mode and sort of just tried to keep Justin Fields healthy. I don't know. Maryland to cover and the under.
I think for this year, my days of, taking 3+ touchdown favorites in Big Ten games are officially over. So, I mean, 25 points... I like Maryland to cover. They've obviously shown some flashes. And I'll take the under because, like, once point totals get over 70, I mean, this is not quite the Big 12 yet, so under.
Yeah, I think if I had to bet anything, it would be the under. I hate doing this, but I'm going to make it a clean sleeve for Maryland, and we're going to move away from this as quickly as possible because I agree with you guys that that's too many points for a team that has shown some holes on defense. At the same time, I could see Ohio State winning this game by 60.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Who knows? But this year is just kind of gross and difficult to bet, especially in the Big Ten. Speaking of gross, Northwestern, -3. I take this back. Speaking of the Big Ten West game of the year, Northwestern -3 at Purdue, over under 50.5. This has actually swung all the way over from Purdue -2, and the total has remained the same. Dan, who's your pick?
As you know, my girlfriend is in the room right now. We are Purdue, baby. I'm shorting a Northwestern Rose Bowl suit soon come. Purdue Rose Bowl suit soon come. Boiler up, Purdue money line, book it. I think every game I've bet on Purdue this year, they've come through. I don't know. Yeah, Pat Fitzgerald is my least favorite coach in the Big Ten. He's going to screw up eventually. So, Purdue.
As much as I appreciate that you had to do that, given that you're in a coercive situation,
I have, abusive relationship.
I have pledged my fealty to the Mike Bajakian imperial era and to our Emperor Bajakian himself. I believe Northwestern Rose Bowl soon come. I'm picking Northwestern in this one. At 50 points, I guess I'll take the over. I do think that, like, this game could become very ugly because it's the Big Ten has been hideous this year and, like, it's just a weird year. But this is probably the most intriguing game this week in the Big Ten, you know, just from a neutral fan standpoint. So, yeah, I think we're farther down the road towards soon come and the Bajakian reign of 1,000 years.
I'm just staring at my cursor in this Google Doc right now because I cannot decide. This is a tough one. It would have been an absolute no-brainer if it had stuck at Purdue -2 or anywhere close, like, or a pick 'em. Giving Northwestern points is terrifying to me. So I think I'm going to take Purdue, and I am also going to take a disgusting under. That it's just gross, but actually how gross I feel about that makes me think that it's actually a good bet, because that's going against the way people are going to want to bet this game. So give me Purdue and just absolutely hideous under 50.5. Speaking of hideous and lines that have flipped, Wisconsin -4 at Michigan, over under 54.5. Michigan opened this game as 3-point favorites, presumably because people thought that the entire Wisconsin team was going to be out with COVID, but still try to play. And this game also opened with just a pathetic point total of 46.5. Dan, do you dare take Michigan now that the line has flipped?
Okay, so look, I've made it clear how bad I feel that Michigan's team is this year. I'm taking a deep breath, and I'm going to deliver this next sentence as carefully as I can. From a value perspective.
Perfect.
From a value perspective, Wisconsin has, like, not practiced all year. If they're going to trot out anything besides their third-string quarterback, he's going to have, like, not practiced. He's not going to have been with the team until, like, you know, the day before the game. There is a chance that Wisconsin comes out in this game just, you know, on the road at the Big House looking complete trash and, like, just, you know, looks like they need to shake the rust off of things. So, you know, give me Michigan money line, but I don't think they're going to, like, I want to be clear. I do not think Michigan's going to win. I think Michigan sucks. But, like, if you're looking to, like, you know, beat Vegas here, I think the play is to take Michigan to win just because there's a chance that Wisconsin is totally disorganized from the top, from, you know, top to bottom. That said, they could be totally disorganized and still beat this team. This team sucks. And you know, I've made it clear that I feel, you know, how I feel about this team. But I'm just, from a purely, like, logical perspective, I think there's value in taking Michigan to win.
So I am really mad at you right now, Dan, because you stepped on my bit. I was going to say all of that. I was going to have you say Wisconsin's going to trounce them, you know, back into the Stone Age, blah, blah, blah. But here you are, you know, showing some cracks in the facade of your, you know, fire Harbaugh and burn it down, you know, mode. Okay, here's my line, guys. I really think we're getting way ahead of ourselves with Wisconsin, a team that had a dire, like, code red COVID outbreak that threatened to derail their season. And their one accomplishment is they beat the brakes off an Illinois team that we know is probably the worst team in the Big Ten with stiff competition. So I, you know, I don't think really know what Wisconsin is yet. We know that Mertz looked promising, but he's a, you know, a true sophomore who, if he's playing, hasn't practiced in 3 weeks. So I think from an actually football standpoint, I don't think Michigan is nearly as out of this game as people think. But I'm picking Wisconsin for betting purposes because I'm not betting on this Michigan team ever again.
I am not doing this for jinx purposes or value purposes or, like, trying to play Vegas purposes. I'm picking Wisconsin because presumably they have watched tape and know that they have receivers who can run fast in a straight line. I'm also taking the under because they have presumably watched tape on Michigan's offense. I don't feel the need to elaborate. I don't want to talk about football anymore. On that note, we are going to thank Connor for joining us because he is off to presumably ponder Bill Watterson and how he can live more like him.
Connor, real quick before you go, I do want to say last week's picks against the spread, I went 2-4, Ace went 4-2, but Connor went 5-1. So who says you can't gamble? Just wanted to point that out.
Put picks in the newsletter. All right. We will be back after this break, and we will be bringing in a guest you will probably recognize.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
It's beginning to look a lot like wood. Follow my every step. Take notes on how I crep. I was about to go in depth. This is the way I creep my season. Here's my get to rep. I kept to say the least. No, it can't cease. So I begin to piece my 2-2 together. Got no snowy weather. Have to find something to do better. Bet I said some time, so shut up that. Nonsense about some solid. I got sick crunk if it ain't real, ain't right. I'm like no matter what the season. Forever chill with Smith. I sit my fifth. I chill with Wesson. Got my reason. So tell me what did you expect? You thought I'd break my neck. To help y'all deck the oh no, I got other means of celebrating. I'm getting blizzard at Hojo, I got the hoochie waking. I made it through another year, can't ask for nothing much more. It's Outcast for the books, I thought you knew, so now you know, let's go.
We welcome in my former, not just a shooter, podcast co-host, Alex Cook, a.k.a. Lord Bonselroy. How's it going in the castle, my friend?
Oh, you know, things are beautiful in the castle. You know, a nice rainstorm is rolling over the concrete courtyard, and West Michigan is as beautiful as ever.
We are not joking, by the way. Alex is literally coming to us from the Grandville Castle. This is a bit that has come to life, and we are all better for it.
Right. Yeah, the level of broken-brained commitment to the bit is extremely 2020, I must say.
So obviously with Alex on the podcast, we are here to switch gears completely and talk about a sport that makes us happy, and that sport is basketball. And we're going to keep the theme of the pod rolling by moving into this with a mailbag question. It's a two-part question. It's from our friend Brian, B-I-S-B, that Brian, because there are so many Brians. He has a two-part question. One, what's up with Musa Diabate? And two, please talk about Musa Diabate. So, Alex, let's start with you. I mean, obviously, Michigan just picked up a five-star who looks to be a potentially program-changing player in 1 year. How do you feel about that pickup?
I mean, it feels great to be the basketball school correspondent for the Ace Pod, I must say, rather than talking about other goings on. But yeah, that Juwan Howard managed to land his second NBA player in the recruiting class for 2021 in about a span of, what, 1 or 2 weeks. This one kind of out of nowhere. Nobody really knew besides Matt D that Jabate was, that we were really seriously on his radar. And yeah, you know, Juwan has shown since he's arrived at Michigan that he wants to recruit the type of players who are obviously, you know, physically ready for the NBA, that will be going the one and done route. You know, he missed out on Josh Christopher and Isaiah Todd, but, you know, with Caleb Houston and now Musa Jabate, Juwan has shown that he's trying to replicate the Duke and Kentucky model of program building. And I don't know, you really love to see it.
Yeah. I have a question.
Oh, yeah, shoot.
As. How will he be used in the pick and roll?
So he will be the pick setter in all likelihood, and he is fascinating because he is a guy who will be a absolutely terrifying roll man with his 7'1" plus wingspan, but also he's got a really nice shooting stroke. So he's going to be someone who can both roll and pop. Michigan has had good roll threats. Michigan has had good pop threats. Michigan hasn't necessarily had somebody who can be both an above the rim finisher and a 3-point shooter as a big man in a screen setter. And whether he's doing that as the 4 or the 5, Giabate's got to just be a huge difference maker in that pick and roll game. So I'm glad you asked, Dan.
Yeah, and I mean, granted, there aren't very many of those types of players in college basketball in general where they're, you know, an elite roll runner, rim runner in the pick and roll and can, you know, pop out, attack closeouts, kind of create with the ball in their hands a little bit. I know Matt has suggested that he likes Jabate mostly at the 5, but with a sophomore Hunter Dickinson on campus, you might see him playing a little bit more as a 4. Which I think that is probably going to be his role at the next level as well, as it's kind of a bigger wing who can slide down to the 5. You know, his rim protection is good. He, you know, he's a hard-nosed player. He doesn't float to the perimeter, even though he has those perimeter skills, which you like, you know, as a potential Big Ten big. And yeah, he definitely will outclass a lot of his competition physically at the college level.
Yeah, I mean, and this is somebody who's going to be a very much a two-way difference maker. You mentioned liking him more at the 5. I agree with that kind of in a vacuum, but I also really like what he brings next to Dickinson in terms of you have this. I think he's the ideal fit in terms of he's going to be able to mask Dickinson's lack of switchability because he can guard possibly every position on the floor. So Michigan is going to at least be able to switch 1 through 4 while also having a weak side shot blocking threat in Giabate, in addition to just a, you know, Ent standing at the rim. So I love the potential he brings on defense and that he can still spread the floor on offense. His tape shows some really nice spot up shooting. So he's somebody, whether he's involved in the play or not, he's going to find a way to be productive. I mean, it's hard to overstate how big of a pickup this is. Obviously, we have the if he sticks caveat, but we'll see. We genuinely don't know right now if the G League is going to be as much of an option and as much of a palatable option to top prospects over the next couple of years, because the NBA is going to face a really significant financial crunch these next couple seasons. Their ratings tanked for their postseason. They lost a ton of revenue from a largely lost season and having to play with no fans. They're looking at putting 40% of players' salary in escrow for this upcoming season and playing a condensed schedule. So hopefully that means the G League is not as much of an option and Giabate sticks. He is supposed to sign his letter of intent, I believe, hopefully by the time you are listening to this. So that would at least keep the Dukes and Kentuckys and whatnot at bay and leave the G League as the only threat. And that'd be a wonderful thing. Before we get to the rest of the very awesome 2021 class, which Alex and I are going to go over, we have one more basketball-related mailbag question, and it does tie into Giabate a little bit, so I wanted to stick this in there. This is via email from Darren. I feel a little concerned that the team is going to be relying on Dickinson so much. I thought that freshman bigs suck is the basketball corollary to freshman wide receivers suck. Is this a legit concern to have? Alex, your thoughts?
I definitely think it is a legit concern to have. You know, Dickinson comes in as a pretty highly rated big, and generally those guys can have quite a bit of success at the college level, you know, in terms of his size and skill level. The Big Ten has some great big men, but that's going to be hard for most people to keep up with. Generally, where freshman bigs suck kind of comes into play is on the defensive end, for one thing. And, you know, there probably will be questions about how Dickinson can guard in space against ball screens, and whether he's going to pick up too many fouls to be able to play, you know, true starter minutes, you know, conditioning at the college level, the physicality for moving up from high school kids to, you know, 22-year-olds that have been playing college basketball for a while. That's always a potential for a problem. But there are options at the five beyond Dickinson. So, you know, Austin Davis, he kind of is a bucket in the post. He showed that he can give a good 8 to 12 minutes per game. Most games he's going to have trouble with certain matchups, but then you have Brandon Johns as a potential small ball five who, you know, maybe is more of a natural power forward, but can guard smaller, quicker players at the five spots. So there are options there, but it is a concern in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever you have a freshman out there, you've got to worry about court sense. You've got to worry about conditioning. I do think Dickinson's size will help offset some of it, just because when you're literally 7'2", that covers for a lot. And I mean, like you said, Michigan does have some other options. So, you know, this isn't going to be a situation, especially now that Chandi Brown is eligible, and that provides some more flexibility if Michigan wants to play Brandon Johns at the five. They've got some options. But there is going to be, you know, I mean, this does feel a little bit like a transition year before the 2021-22 season is really when things take off. And on that note, we're going to go over the rest of the number one recruiting class in the country, even before Giabate committed. And that continues with Caleb Houston, the other five-star in the class. From the other kind of powerhouse academy in this country, Monteverde. He is a 6'8 wing forward-ish type. He is currently the number 8 player on the composite, and he is an absolutely killer shooter. Alex, what are you excited about in terms of what he brings to the table?
So, yeah, like you said, Houston played on a powerhouse high school team. He played along future potential first-round pick Cade Cunningham, who's a tall point guard. He also played with fellow five-stars Scotty Barnes and De'Ron Sharp. So Houston's role was mostly to play off the ball and shoot the ball, and he comes in as one of the best shooters in the class. He has the ability to shoot off the dribble, and at 6'8", you know, that's a tough shot for any defender to contest. He did flash a little bit more versatility playing for the Canadian national team, but he's another guy with, you know, future NBA potential. He's not quite the athlete that Giabate is, or that maybe like Josh Christopher or Isaiah Todd were, in terms of five stars, but he could be, you know, a potential 2-year player, potential future lottery pick, and really slides in as a nice complement to Michigan's more ball dominant guards potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I love what he brings in terms of a little bit of versatility, again, on the wings, because he's somebody who could play the 3 or the 4. The idea of him playing the 3 next to Giabate and Dickinson has got to be kind of a nightmare for defenses just to figure out how to deal with that combination of size and skill. And he's somebody who, I mean, he could be a one-and-done with that shot and size, given what NBA teams are looking for these days. But he's not the world's most explosive athlete. So there's a chance you keep him around on campus for more than one season. That is almost certainly not going to happen with Giabate. That's going to be a one-and-done situation, which is fine. It's great to be able to get those guys. But it'd be nice if Houston, maybe you get a second season out of him where he really blows up. The next guy moving down the composite rankings is still in the top 60. That is Nevada point guard Frankie Collins. Alex, what do you think of him and what he brings to the table?
Real quick before we get to Collins, I would like to point out that, you know, as you mentioned, having Houston and Giabate at the 3 and 4 with Dickinson potentially at the 5, that's really where you're starting to look like a Kentucky or a Duke, both in terms of, you know, turning the program over every year with NBA departures, 5 stars coming in, you know, really pursuing the grad transfer market, and having the type of size and talent that just overwhelms most teams. So, I mean, there definitely are cautionary examples of that in college basketball, that model not working out. But, you know, as you know, Juwan kind of establishes himself as a head coach, I think we'll really see a lot of year-to-year turnover. As for Collins, he strikes me as a pretty exciting type of player. I'm excited to see him on campus. He's, you know, not the biggest guy. He's kind of that archetypal Philly guard, even though he's from out west, where, you know, he's not a big primary ball handler, but he's very quick, athletic, gets downhill, plays tough, more of a drive and kick player. But yeah, he definitely will figure in and could be the lead guard in 2021-22.
And this does seem like, I mean, you know, given the bringing in Mike Smith and targeting him by Juwan Howard, and kind of a similar player, at least in terms of the kind of size that they're bringing and some of the skills that they bring, where, you know, not necessarily great size, but can break down a defense. This might be kind of Howard's type, where he's willing to have and happy to have kind of a smaller attacking guard, point guard out there, while the rest of his team is absolutely enormous and terrifying. Next up, and possibly passing Collins at some point, given recent performances, somebody from your neck of the woods, Grand Rapids Christian, shooting guard Kobe Bufkin, who currently stands at 6'4", and like I said, has been really impressing lately.
Yeah, I actually used to live right down the street from Grand Rapids Christian in Alger Heights. He's going to be the first Wolverine on the basketball team since Kelvin Grady, which is a blast from the past. But he definitely is, you know, more of a two guard than Collins. Collins is more of strictly a point guard. But Bufkin has the ability to be a scoring primary ball handling guard, can score from all three levels, can create his own shot from distance. Really great shooter, and, you know, the type of all-around offensive player that, you know, could project to a starting role right away.
Yeah, I mean, I love his shot, and as a two guard, that's the main thing you're looking at. He has decent size, which for Michigan, especially on the defensive end, is something that you're looking for. And he's another guy who just seems to have a lot of talent, seems to fit in with kind of the offensive direction that this team is going. The last 4-star in this class is Isaiah Barnes out of Chicago Simeon, Juwan Howard's neck of the woods. He is a 6'6 wing and another pretty versatile 3-and-D guy.
Yeah, he definitely has the potential to play the 3 or 4 at the college level, I think. He was a guy who committed very early before interest could have potentially come in from some bigger name schools. Like you said, he's a 4-star. I think, you know, based on what the rest of the roster could look like in 2021-22, especially after Houston committed, that he'll be kind of battling for a rotation spot. But you got to figure he will be the type of player who can give quality minutes and potentially start as an upperclassman.
Yeah, when that's the number 5 guy in your class, that is pretty strong. The number 6 final member of the class is kind of the developmental guy, although he's still practically in the top 150 at 155 nationally. That's Will Shetter out of Minnesota, Stuartville. I don't think that is a renowned basketball powerhouse. But he's got a bit of stretch to him as a big man, and I don't know, what do you see his potential program contribution being?
I mean, I've seen enough of these types of players light it up for Wisconsin over the years that I definitely won't write off Shedder as a contributor. You know, you got to figure you probably won't get minutes over Jabate, a senior Brandon Johns, or Hunter Dickinson, but pick and pop five definitely has that kind of inside out game. In terms of rounding out the class with a big man who could potentially be on campus for a while, with the other early entry candidates, makes a lot of sense for how big of a class it's going to be.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you in terms of it. It's just you want to try to get at least one or two, you know, quote unquote program guys in at big man, just because you always need depth there. Generally, those guys, if they're not the kind of tip-top recruits that Michigan is taking and will cycle through relatively quickly because those guys go off to the NBA, big men take a while to really round into quality Big Ten players. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, this is a guy that, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to see him emerge at Wisconsin as a junior or senior and be a thorn in the Big Ten side. So for Michigan to get a guy like that, again, as the number six prospect in a six-man class right now, and who knows, they might add a seventh depending on how they project the roster going forward, because they're at the scholarship limit right now with no projected attrition, and no attrition is not a thing that happens in college basketball. So there's a chance to add to this, but as it stands right now, this is the number one class in the country, and even though there's time for the Kentuckys and Dukes to catch up, this is a class that is almost certainly going to stick in the top five, probably the top three, and might even stay at number one nationally, depending on how things shake out with re-ranks and whatnot. So just an incredibly promising class from Juwan Howard, and I'm feeling pretty good about my hot take on the podcast from last week that Juwan Howard might win a national title within 4 years. So
he's definitely going to have that kind of talent on campus, and it's really a shame that we couldn't see what the fully synthesized version of his year one team looked like because of injuries and because of the season getting cut short. But I think it'll be, you know, a very interesting type of tenure where it really is a new chapter every season. You know, this year you have the backcourt led by Smith and Brooks, Isaiah Livers. He's, you know, been around for quite a while now, but yeah, it'll be fun to follow. And, you know, you can't really argue that Juwan hasn't been a good hire.
Yeah, no, this is looking like a home run. And I mean, it's hard to overstate the excitement around the basketball program right now. And we dearly need that. So on that uplifting note, we are going to end this podcast at a swift hour and 40 minutes or so. This is the one we were definitely trying to run through fast, but things happen.
I like to think that I went pretty fast with the basketball part.
Oh, yeah. No, this was largely on us rambling about depressing football things, and that's not on you. Our beloved basketball correspondent.
The good vibes guy.
Yes, you definitely get to be the good vibes guy at this point. Dan has left the room because this was Dan's basketball podcast style. On that note, thank you to everybody for tuning in. Thank you to the law offices of EJ's and Blankenship for sponsoring us. And we will catch you next week. Cue the music.